the 27th study of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 7th of September 1976. Brother John Knowles, speaking to the subject, the position of the angel and how it is acquired, and the reading, Isaiah chapter 19.
We are now commenced to say meeting by singing together hymn number 8. Hymn number 8. Ask our secretary to lead us in the reading of Isaiah chapter 19. Brother Norm Lloyd.
Reading together the 19th chapter of the prophet Isaiah. The burden of Egypt. Behold, Yahweh rideth upon a swift cloud, and shall come into Egypt. And the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians. And they shall fight every one against his brother, and every one against his neighbour, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof. And I will destroy the counsel thereof, and they shall seek unto the idols, and unto the charmers, and unto them that have familiar spirits, and to the wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord Yahweh of armies. And the waters shall fail from the sea, and the rivers shall be wasted and dried up. And they shall turn the rivers far away, and the brooks of defences shall be emptied and dried up. The reeds and the flags shall wither. The paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither, be driven away, and be no more. The fishers also shall mourn, and all they that cast angles into the brooks shall lament. And they that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. Moreover, they that work in fine flax, and they that weave networks, shall be confounded. and they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for fishes. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools, and the counselor of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? Where are they? Where are thy wise men? Let them tell thee now, and let them know that Yahweh of armies hath purposed upon Egypt. The princes of Zoan are become fools, the princes of Noph are deceived, and they have also seduced Egypt, even they that are the stay of the tribes thereof. Yahweh hath mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggereth in his vomit. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt, which the head or tail, branch or rush may do. In that day shall Egypt be like unto a woman, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of Yahweh of armies, which he shaketh over it. And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Every one that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself, because of the counsel of Yahweh of armies, which he hath determined against it. In that day shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan, and swear to Yahweh of armies. One shall be called the city of destruction. In that day shall there be an altar to Yahweh in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to Yahweh. And it shall be for a sign, and for a witness unto Yahweh of armies in the land of Egypt. For they shall cry unto Yahweh because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a saviour, and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And Yahweh shall be known to Egypt. And the Egyptians shall know Yahweh in that day, and shall do sacrifices and oblations. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto Yahweh and perform it. And Yahweh shall smite Egypt, and shall smite and heal it. And they shall return even to Yahweh, and he shall be entreated of them, and shall heal them. In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Syria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrian. In that day shall Israel be a third with Egypt and with Syria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom Yahweh of armies shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Syria, the work of my hand, and Israel, mine inheritance.
I'll then cut over to John, and he will exhort us to the theme, the position of the angel, how it is acquired. And the reference was of Volume 2 of Eureka, pages 552 to 567. Well done.
Dear class members, well, as we are aware, what we are doing at the moment is following the section on the rainbowed angel from Eureka, and this is the third night where we've been looking at this particular section. Bear in mind, we are studying at the moment Revelation chapter 10, and in Revelation chapter 10, this angel with the rainbow about its head is set with one foot on the earth and one foot on the sea. And this section in Eureka is particularly showing us how the angel comes into this position. So I'm just repeating this each time, just so we can see the overall section that we're dealing with. Revelation chapter 10 simply says that the angel stood with one foot on the earth and one foot on the sea. Brother Thomas is showing us how it gets to this position, because the time when it stands with one foot on the sea and one foot on the earth is quite some time after that angel has been first formed. In other words, there is the return of Christ, there is the resurrection of the dead, there is the judgment, there is the march from Sinai, there is the subjugation of the Arabs, the march into Egypt, Armageddon and so forth before it can be said that this angel is standing completely with its feet on the earth and on the sea. So that is why this section is entitled The Position of the Angel and How It Is Acquired. And we're looking particularly at how it is acquired. As a result of last class, there were two or three people asked the same question, which was, I think, a very discerning question, and I feel satisfied in my own mind that I had the answer. Not sure whether I satisfied all the people who asked it, but maybe there are one or two others who had the same question in mind, and I think perhaps it would be appropriate to give you what I consider is my answer at this stage. Go back for a moment to Deuteronomy chapter 33, that chapter that we were looking at. Remember, in Deuteronomy chapter 33, we show that there was a progression there in verse 2, that Moses said, Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000s of saints. So that literally rendered, it was Yahweh set forth from Sinai. He dawned out of Seir upon them. He shone forth out of Mount Paran, showing a progression there. So he sets forth from Sinai, he rises up over the horizon in the sense of the sun dawning from Seir, and then shines forth in the more fullness of in a fuller sense of his glory when he comes to the area of Paran. And in looking at a map, a person would say, well, that doesn't quite seem to be the order, because here's Sinai, there's Paran, and there's Seir or Edom. Surely then the order is incorrect, or something of that nature. I don't think anyone said the order is incorrect, they just said, well, how come? Well, I think it comes in this way, that he certainly sets forth from the area of Sinai, then he moves into the area of the subjugation of the Arab nations, the land of Midian and the tents of Cushan, which are referred to in Habakkuk, and then marches into Egypt and comes back then into the wilderness of Paran. This is after the type of the Exodus in the days of Moses. You can see the line here. They came out of Egypt, down here to Sinai, then they marched up into the borders of Edom, and then they came back and they wandered in the wilderness of Paran. So the order was Sinai, Seir, which is Edom, and Paran. And I see in the antitype as well that that would seem to be the same pattern. So maybe there were one or two others had the same question, and that is my suggestion as to what the answer is, that that is in fact the order, both in the type as far as the original Exodus is concerned, and in the antitype, as we shall see this evening, from Sinai into the Arab land, into Egypt, and then back into the wilderness of Paran. So in case some were studying this in detail and wondered about the order, I feel that is what is being suggested there. There was also a suggestion, and I think there is some validity in this too, that not only do we look at the literal names of these places, but of course the meanings of the names can also be significant. Well, let's then take up our study from where we left off, and what I want to do, so that we don't lose track of the main theme in our study of Revelation, is that in this section I want to keep moving fairly well tonight. I think we can afford to move at a slightly faster pace than we have on the two previous nights, presuming that everybody has by this stage now read this section probably several times over. You know the parts that you've got some difficulties with, and what I would like to suggest is that questions do be kept to the end, because I think some of you will have questions, and I promised to finish earlier. I'll finish, God willing, at 9:15, and then any questions we'll take at that stage. Right, we left off at the beginning of the last paragraph, page 552, in the black edition, and for the red edition, I don't know, but it starts with these words. When the angels of the Lord's tower shall have finished the gathering of the saints from one end of the heavens to the other, they will have collected together a cloud of witnesses, by whom will be concentrated in one general assembly the living history of all ages and generations. Now, what Brother Thomas has done is that in the preceding paragraph, He showed how when the Lord Jesus Christ returned, he would come with what is styled the angels of his power. The angels of his power being the expression which he referred to several times in pages 551 and 552. So then he comes with the angels of his power. When he comes then with the angels of his power, he gathers together his saints from the one end of heaven to the other. This, of course, is an allusion back to Matthew 24, verse 31, which I commented on last time and said, well, whilst I agree in principle that this is what will happen, I wasn't so sure that Matthew 24, verse 31, in its context, was talking about that particular gathering. You may remember our comments on that at the end. But nevertheless, I see no reason at all to disagree with what he is saying in this paragraph, except he is, in fact, paraphrasing Matthew 24, verse 31, and as such, I believe the principle in general is correct. He says he will have collected them together as a cloud of witnesses, by whom will be concentrated in one general assembly the living history of all ages and generations. Well, we've looked at the theme of the clouds, and we've seen how that the cloud of witnesses, as they at present exist, are generally in the grave. They will nevertheless come forth from the grave. And what was a cloud of witnesses in their day and generation during their pilgrimage will become the clouds of the future age, pregnant, says Brother Thomas, with thunderings and with lightning. So he will gather together those who now are a cloud of witnesses and have been in their day and generation, and he will proceed to form them into these thunder clouds, stage two of the clouds. You know, you remember the diagrams back in volume one and two of the notes. In order to manifest God's judgment, there will be, he says, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Shem, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Elijah, David, Daniel, John, and all the prophets and apostles, with a multitude beside that no man can number, all in their day intelligent in the word and zealous for the truth, in the service of which many were accounted fools and many lost their lives. In the later ages of their separation from the nations, the governments of the Gentiles, symbolized by the beast and his image, made war upon them and overcame them or prevailed against them. And a couple of references there from Revelation and Daniel. Now that the Ancient of Days has come to Sinai, and they are gathered unto him, and approved on the ground of having continued in the faith, rooted and settled and not moved away from the hope of the gospel, they are transformed and become like Christ Jesus in all things, except that he is preeminent in rank and authority. In other words, he says they are equal to the angels and die no more. He doesn't say the and die no more, but you see he's quoted Luke 20 verse 36, and that's what that passage says, that in the resurrection they shall be equal unto the angels and die no more. So really he's simply saying in this paragraph that when the Lord returns with the angels of his power, he will use these angels of his power to gather together the saints. And there will be Abel, Enoch, Noah, and so forth. Now, reader, ascend with me into the Mount of the Elohim, and from the top of the rocks look into the open spaces of this elevated region of the peninsula. What seest thou outspread before thee? And he's going to start to draw a picture now, drawn from the prophecy of Balaam. You remember when Balak hired Balaam to curse Israel? And Balaam stood up in these various vantage points and he looked down upon the tents of Israel. And Balaam's prophecy became a prophecy of the latter day. And Brother Thomas makes an allusion to this here. In fact, more than an allusion, he actually quotes it. But what he's doing here is he's taking us into a similar situation to Balaam. He said, just as Balaam looked down upon the encampment of Israel after they'd come out of Egypt and there they were gathered, he says, let us now, like Balaam, look down upon the antitypes of this generation of people who are now prepared to march forth from Sinai. So he says, what seest thou outspread before thee? What but the goodly tents and tabernacles of the holy nation? Notice in inverted commas, it's not so much now that literal nation that came out of Egypt, but it's this holy nation, the chosen generation, the royal priesthood, the purchased people, the Israel of God. And he quotes there 1 Peter 2 verse 9. So Peter takes up those words which in the first instance were applied to Israel after the flesh, And now, says Dr. Thomas, let's come up into the mountain like Balaam did, and now let's look down upon this spiritual Israel, gathered together there in their encampment at Sinai. And then he now merges his thoughts into the words of Balaam's prophecy. As the valleys are they spread forth as gardens by the river's side, as the trees of line arrows which Yahweh hath planted, as cedar trees beside the waters, whose king shall be higher than Agag, or Gog, he says. In the Authorized Version, it's Agag. The Septuagint version makes it Gog. The Septuagint version makes it Gog. And his kingdom shall be exalted. Behold them abiding according to their tribes, those tribes apocalyptically sealed in their foreheads, the seal of the deity. And so there he is, quoting from the prophecy of Balaam, and in a sense taking us forward. He doesn't tell us where he's quoting from. So where was it? Numbers 24, verse 6. Okay, so we note that down in the margin. Numbers 24, verse 6. Now, of course, one would be tempted to say, well, let's do a study of the prophecy of Balaam. It's a very, very good study to do, but not tonight. Anyway, there's no doubt that Balaam was prophetically speaking of the time when there would be a king over these people whose king would be higher than Gog. And so this latter day prophecy then presents us with the fact that here is a group of people, the antitype of Israel in the wilderness in the days of Moses, who are now about to go forward with their king and subdue Gog and the other nations referred to in the various prophecies. He says, how beautiful are they in their encampment, who, as the four living ones, lie four square, and as broad, yes, and as broad as their length, being 144 cubits, which is the measure of a man, that is of an angel, even of the rainbowed angel. So he brings together here several ideas. Just as Israel's encampment in the wilderness was four square, so he says in the Revelation, the spiritual Israel is also a four square encampment, 144 cubits, 12 by 12. 12 broad, 12 long, therefore making 144 square cubits, if you like, which is the measure of a man, that is of an angel, even the rainbowed angel, whose altitude is equal to his breadth, an altitude by which his relationship to the light which no man can approach unto is established and revealed. And so he's saying that here is a group of people now being made equal unto the angels. They've been granted immortality, and now they are the true Israel of God. Very beautiful language, and it presents to us in highly symbolical words, piecing together various prophecies, the picture of the saints in their encampment. But why do they lie there in their encampment? What is their angelism? I bet you've never come across that word before. Angelism. Has anyone ever come across it outside? I've never heard of it before, apart from here. You have heard of it before. Oh, it's in the vocabulary of the Greek New Testament. Well, what does it mean then? Yes, I guess that's all it does. The word angel means a messenger, doesn't it? So what is their angelism? In other words, what's the message they're going to bring? What is that that they're going to convey? And so I think he coined the word actually, but anyway, if you found it in a concordance or lexicon, whatever what you said it was, very good. But there you are, it's an interesting little word. It simply means, what is their message? What is the mission they're going to perform? So why do they lie there in their encampment? What is their angelism? What is the message? Why are they thus marshalled? And here it comes, another quote. Looking forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. Where'd that come from? Song of Solomon 6 verse 10. Right. So, once again, we could be tempted to go and do a study of that. But doesn't it show to us how much there is in the Bible that actually speaks on this? You see, we could do a study of the prophecy of Balaam. Several chapters of the scripture, which obviously refer to the events of the time of the end. Here's the Song of Solomon also depicting it. So really, when we sit down and look at the Bible, there is a lot of information concerning this latter-day manifestation. And look at the symbols. We've already considered such symbols as this. looking forth as the morning, fair as the moon, a symbol of the ecclesia, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. Why have they been hastily transported hither in clouds? Why are they here in convention with the Lord in the aerial? Aerial is a term Brother Thomas uses quite a lot in his writings. It just simply means the aerial, the elevated place. Inasmuch as the term heavens is used of the ruling systems, and as Thessalonian says that we shall meet the Lord in the air or in the aerial, it means in the elevated regions. Not so much in a physical sense, but certainly in a political, well, not even political quite at this stage, but certainly in an elevated spiritual sense, ultimately to be an elevated political sense as well. So here are the kings and priests in prospect, those who are going forth to take the power to themselves. They are in convention with the Lord in this aerial region, this elevated region. Are they to remain here permanently encamped in the elevated region of the peninsula? No, the wilderness of Sinai is only the place of gathering where the saints are organized and developed into this mighty angel. They are the swift cloud upon which the Spirit rides. Now, here we're starting to get together with this main theme which we've been following. They are the cloud. The clouds have brought us back from Revelation into Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy told us about this cloud in chapter 33, verse 26. There is none like unto the ale of Yeshurun, who rideth upon the heaven in thy help, and in his excellency on the sky. Or, as it could be translated, there is none like the ale of Yeshurun, riding upon the heavens to thy help, and for his own majesty on the clouds. Here then is this cloud upon which Yahweh is going to ride. But he says they are the swift cloud upon which the Spirit rides. Now this then is the bridging link with our reading tonight, Isaiah 19. So Deuteronomy 33 shows him setting forth out of Sinai, rising as the sun out of Seir, and shining forth as Mount Paran, this swift cloud. But in the process of this, this swift cloud is going to come into Egypt. That's what we were told in Isaiah 19, weren't we, tonight? And that's going to be a fair part of our consideration. So he's already laying the basis for this. This is a technique which Brother Thomas uses, a very, very skillful technique. He makes a statement, and then perhaps a little later, maybe a page, 2 pages, or even more, he takes a quotation, which in fact is the very statement which he's made a page or so earlier. You see, he says here, they are the swift cloud upon which the Spirit rides. And then in a short time, he's going to refer us to Isaiah 19. You say, hey, that's marvellous. It's all there in Isaiah 19. Well, actually, he has very cleverly introduced the thought into our mind before he comes to it, which in fact is a very good technique, I guess, and it certainly makes his writing very exciting to read. So he's got swift cloud there in capitals. I think if italics are meant to emphasise something, then capitals are even more important, because he doesn't use capitals as much as he does italics, and this swift cloud then is going to become a very important theme. So the swift cloud is going to, well, we don't know yet, but we're going to see in a moment that it'll march into Egypt. In their camp, they are but waiting for judgment to be given to them. Waiting for judgment to be given to them? In inverted commas, must be a quote. Daniel 7, right, yes. We've been looking them up, haven't we? This is good. Daniel chapter 7. As a matter of fact, I only wrote Daniel chapter 7 down and didn't even bother to look up the verses. What verse was it? 22. We've got that, Daniel 7 verse 22. See that one there? They are waiting for the judgment to be given to them, that they may go forth and take possession of the kingdom under the whole heaven. And that's also a continuation of the same quote. He stood and measured the earth. So now here is this angel, ready to go forth. But he says, before I go forth, I'm going to measure the earth. The word measure, or rather the terms associated with measure, like the measuring line, are frequently used in the sense of judgment. The line is used as a symbol of judgment. But here is this angel figuratively measuring the earth. He's preparing to go forth and to judge it. But that's in inverted commas too. He stood and measured the earth. So that must be a quote from somewhere. Same person answering them all. I hope it's just that she's quicker than everybody else. Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 6. Right. So, of course, it's recurring theme, isn't it? Habakkuk chapter 3, and we'll have to go to Habakkuk shortly and have a good look at that chapter because it's coming up so much. So you see the picture now. The swift cloud is waiting to go forth, waiting for the judgment to be given to them that they may go forth and take possession of the kingdom, and they're standing now there and measuring the earth. The wings of their flight upon the prey are not yet expanded. The wings of their flight upon the prey are not yet expanded. Though they had been gathered by the angels of his power into the presence of Israel's king, preparation for action upon the outer world was not complete. The wings, what's this a reference to? See, the cherubim, wouldn't it? Yes. Now, their wings are not expanded. In other words, they're like the cherubim. Their wings are at rest. It's, of course, a reference to Ezekiel chapter 1 and other such similar passages where the symbol of the cherubim occurs. So they are this cherubic chariot of Yahweh. There's just so many ideas being brought in here. Let's just follow the idea of the cloud. They are the cloud. You know, the eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms. It's like that cherubim of Ezekiel chapter 1 with the arms underneath the wings. Here then the wings are, at the moment, drooped down by the side. They're resting. But shortly they're going to be expanded, and either following the symbol of the cherubim with the wings propelling it through the air, or else as the cloud on which Yahweh will ride, they are preparing to go forth. Israel after the flesh has to be made willing to move in obedience to the commands of Jesus as the leader and commander of the people. And he quotes Psalm 110 verse 3. The insertion of that particular statement at this particular time is a little curious. That's a funny way to expound the thing, but anyway, I think it's curious that he should insert that at this stage. I think this statement has led some people to believe that at this epoch then, a command goes forward to Israel, Israel being the tribe still in dispersion, incidentally, not Judah in the land, that the commencement of the work of Elijah, rather, the work of Elijah commences at this stage. I don't think so. And certainly Brother Thomas is quite adamant in the Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land Explained that the work of Elijah commences, quote, subsequent to Armageddon, that's after Armageddon, and prior to the gathering of Israel into the wilderness of the people. Now, what I'm going to suggest here, I guess some of you have had difficulty in trying to follow some of Brother Thomas's reasoning here, particularly if you've compared it with, say, what he said in the Mystery of the Covenant. I feel that to do justice to what Brother Thomas has said and to correlate the two, I think he has drawn a parallel between the two works which are to be performed. Now let me briefly explain what I mean by this for the sake of those who haven't perhaps studied this subject before. The Jewish people who are in the land at the present moment and who are gathered prior to the return of Christ are constituted Judah after the pattern of the fact that in the days following the reign of Solomon, the kingdom was divided into Judah in the south and Israel or Ephraim in the north, right? Ephraim or Israel were scattered by the Assyrians, and 100 or so years later, the Babylonians came down and took Judah. It was therefore Judah that returned from Babylon, not Israel. It was Judah that was in the land at the time of the Lord Jesus Christ. And as far as Zechariah is concerned, it is the tents of Judah which are to be saved first. Therefore, those who are now in the land are styled Judah. The Jewish people who are still in dispersion and will remain in dispersion until after Gog has been destroyed are styled Israel. So there are to be two gatherings. You know, Elpis Israel, page 441 down the bottom, there is then a partial and primary regathering of Jews before the manifestation of Christ in the earth, which is to serve as the nucleus or basis of future operations in the restoration of the rest of the tribes after he has appeared in the kingdom. The pre-adventual colonization of Palestine will be on purely political principles, and you know the rest of the story. So the pre-adventual colonization of Palestine necessitates a gathering of Jews into the land. And whilst Brother Thomas doesn't use it in this particular section, he does quote Isaiah chapter 6 in Eureka volume 3. And I only noticed this recently. I thought it was very, very interesting. Isaiah in chapter 6, speaking about the ultimate manifestation of glory in the earth, says in verse 13, "But yet in it shall be a tent, and it shall return and shall be eaten as a teal tree and as an oak, whose substance is in them when they cast their leaves, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof." Now Brother Thomas states that this verse refers to the regathering of Jewish people to the land prior to Armageddon. He says it will only constitute a tenth part of what will ultimately constitute the kingdom. That is, the promises made to Abraham. Now this is interesting. If you have a look at... That's not good enough. But if you had a look at... We'll take a map of this nature here, which I'll hold up and show to you. Here's the Middle East today. The promises to Abraham constitute the land from the Euphrates across here to the Nile. The territory which Israel at the present time holds is approximately one-tenth of that land, which is very interesting. Approximately one-tenth of the territory promised to Abraham as the nucleus of the kingdom. So that Brother Thomas says that prior to the gathering, prior to the Battle of Armageddon, the land occupied by Israel will constitute a tenth part of that which they shall ultimately receive. So what's going to happen then is that Judah in the land, as a result of the Battle of Armageddon, will have to be disciplined, they will have to be chastened. A third part of them will be brought out of the refiner's fire. And so what is going to happen to Judah will also happen in a parallel sense to Israel, those who are to be gathered back afterwards. Now, I don't know how clear that is. I can see a few frowns, so perhaps that's not all that clear. I think it'll become clearer as we go on. Now, what I'm suggesting is this. In The Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land Explained, an excellent book which if you haven't read, you must read it immediately, I think Brother Thomas is extremely clear there. I don't see any problems. And he deals there almost entirely with what's going to happen after Armageddon as Elijah goes forth to gather back Israel to the land. Now that's very clear. In this section here, he is dealing with the work before Armageddon, and the quotes that he uses in the mystery, which he applies to Israel after Armageddon, he uses the same quotes here to apply to the work to be performed in Judah prior to Armageddon. So what I'm suggesting is that Brother Thomas actually sees a parallel series of events. That in fact Judah has to be saved on similar principles to Israel. Judah prior to Armageddon, or as part of Armageddon, and Israel after it. So if we have some difficulty saying, how come he applies Psalm 110 verse 3 here, apparently to Judah, when in the Mystery of the Covenant he applies it to Israel, well, the answer is that he sees one as being parallel to the other. But I don't think that justifies us saying that Elijah is to go forth at this point of time to start regathering Israel, as is suggested in some commentaries. I don't think it's right. Brother Thomas, in my understanding, nowhere says that. He says, in fact, quite clearly and quite categorically the opposite. Well, then why does he at this stage insert this point that Israel after the flesh has to be made willing to move in obedience to the commands of Jesus as the leader and commander of the people? Well, I come back to my original statement. It is curious that he puts it in at this point. He doesn't seem to make anything of it. He goes on to say, with another statement which I also think is a little unusual, and whilst I don't want to deprecate the doctor's writings in any shape or form, I have put a question mark by it in my margin. He says, this may be also the mission of the angels. I don't know why he should say this, because he then goes on to show that it's not, in fact. He says, but the work of the Spirit, however, executed by the angels or by the saints, it would seem to be a necessary preliminary to a general movement for their deliverance. This is after the order of the type. The Spirit's messenger in the bush sent Moses and Aaron to the elders of Israel to make the people willing to remove from Egypt under their leadership before any communication was opened with the court of Pharaoh or any judgment had been inflicted upon their enemies and oppressors. Well, then, having made that statement, he then goes back to Sinai and shows to us progressively the movement from there. Well, then, why has he inserted this thought at this stage? I think he has, in fact, just done that. I think he's inserted the thought and said, right, they're going to march forth from Sinai, and they're going to move into some of these lands, but why are they going to do this? Well, it's important to remember that Israel's got to be prepared as well. They've got to be made willing in the day of his power. And whilst he's not explaining at this stage how that will happen, he simply makes the statement. And I don't think he's meaning us to understand that this is a chronological order of events, that while they're there in Sinai, that some sort of mission is to go forth from Sinai to prepare Israel out in America and Australia and wherever else they might be. I think he is simply saying that part of the work of this angel will eventually be to make Israel willing. And in fact, he's going to go on now, in the rest of this section, to simply talk about the work of Judah and not about Israel anyway. So it's an interesting little insert here. I think it is just a general statement, and not to be taken in any sense in some sort of chronological order. We must bear in mind, after all, we are studying a book written by a man. We are not studying inspired scripture, and whilst we would consider that his writing is extremely good, we mustn't at any stage say then, this has got to be right. If I can't understand it, then I'm not understanding the inspired writings of Brother Thomas. I think we are at least permitted to say that he does make some statements at times which show to us, of course, that he just wasn't inspired. Why, for example, does he say, but the work, this may also be the mission of the angels? Perhaps he had some doubt in his mind as to whether the angels may also be involved in it. I don't think so. I don't think the angels will be involved in this. I think Hebrews is quite clear. Unto the angels hath he not put in subjection the world to come whereof we now speak. And it's the work of the rainbowed angels. However, he made the statement, and if you've got some thoughts on it afterwards, we'll by all means make them. Well, having inserted that, we now come back to our theme in the next paragraph. But all things being prepared, the quietude of the camp of Sinai is changed for the noise of great waters. The scene becomes tempestuous. When they stood inactive, they let down their wings. Ah, that's what he said on the previous page, you see. This allusion to Ezekiel chapter 1, verse... I have got the verse down this time, by the way. Verse... You didn't look it up, did you? 24, that's right. It's like a 6 in my book, 24. That's it. The scene becomes tempestuous. When they stood inactive, they let down their wings. But judgment having been given to them, they extend their wings, and the noise thereof is the noise of a host marching against the foe. Habakkuk saw this angelic multitudinous unity in full career. They would, of course, attack the peoples first who were nearest to their encampment. These are the tents of Cushan and the curtains of Midian, which are afflicted and made to tremble. This Cushan is east of the Tigris and north of the Persian Gulf. The Midianites are the Arabs of the desert who are to bow before him. So he's suggesting that on the basis of what Habakkuk said, the first area that they would move into is the area of Cushan and Midian. Now he says here, this Cushan, because there were various areas styled Cushan, this Cushan is east of the Tigris and north of the Persian Gulf. He makes quite a distance over that way, and he also links up with it the Midianites, who he says are the Arabs of the desert. You may like to make a note of some other writing which Brother Thomas has made on this score, and it's in Eureka Volume 3, page 599, in the black edition, or Volume 3b, page 202, when he says, and I'll read from it, Midian had a terrible day when, by a panic from Yahweh, they destroyed themselves in the presence of Gideon and his 300 torch-bearing trumpeters. Another similar day is in reserve for Midian and Cushan when Eloah shall come in from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. From before him shall go the pestilence, and flaming fire shall go forth from his feet. He stood and shall shake the earth. He beheld and shall cause the nations to tremble, and the mountains of antiquity shall be dispersed. The ancient hills were humbled. The ways of Olam are for him. In consequence of this terrible manifestation of supernatural power, Habakkuk informs the reader, saying, I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. The lands of Cushan and Midian, being within the limits of the land granted to Abraham, remember the point I made earlier? They are within the limits of the land granted to Abraham, are among the first to feel the sword of the king who begins his conquering career in Timnath. Like his father David, he executes judgment upon the inhabitants of the south before he obtains the sovereignty over the house of Judah in the midst of the land. And he's quite adamant there. It's Judah that he's going to reign over first. Now that's interesting, because it's in this particular section of Eureka that he deals with that quote from Isaiah 6. Now, I think what this really means in regard to the tents of Cushan and Midian being in affliction, and there is some doubt as to the exact locality of Cushan and Midian. At least there is some difference of opinion between Arnold and myself. I'm sorry, Arnold and Brother Thomas, as to exactly where it is. But if we were to look at this, we can reconcile both ideas, and we can both be quite adequately catered for. Brother Thomas is suggesting that Cushan is over here further, virtually over in the area of Iraq, and Arnold feels that it should be down more in the area of Sinai. You've got to be down to 9:15. oh, I'm misquoting, sorry. Well, anyway, there are these various areas, and there are two or three different suggestions as to where the area of Cushan can be. But I think the interesting point is this, that the Lord is going...